Yes, something a little different we were able to have for you this year. Mr. Phil Brandy, from the Orange County Archives, going to speak on the Spanish and Mexican rancheros here in Orange County, a little bit of the history of where all this came from. Phil's been research and writing Orange County history since 1975. Is the author of more than a dozen local history books and hundreds of articles. Since 2003, he served as the county archivist here in Orange County, which is under the clerk recorder's office. Please welcome Phil Brandini.
Well, I have to apologize. I know I don't fit your stereotype of what a historian is supposed to look like. I'm sorry. I've only been doing this for 30 years now, so I haven't had a chance to get the gray hair and the long beard and still drive a Model T. I hate to disrupt people's stereotypes, though. It's very painful to me. As they said, since you were kind enough all to come down here to Orange County, we thought this morning we might talk a little bit about something particular to Orange County, and what's more specific to an area than its local history. Though I also wanted to pick a subject that applies most anywhere in California, that except for some of the very northernmost counties and a few on the eastern edge of the state, the Spanish, the Mexican ranchos, that part of our history is shared by all of us and still influencing all of our counties, all of California, almost all of California today. Let me just start with the big picture, give you the little California History 101, just so everyone's up to speed. I know if you grew up here, you got this all in the fourth grade, but you've maybe forgotten a little bit of it since then. But California, as you know, is that part of the New World that was assigned to Spain as part of their territory, and Spain, frankly, did almost nothing about it for about 250 years. They sent a few explorations north by ship as early as 1542 when Cabrillo came north, but really, while they would have told you, yes, we have, California's ours, they didn't do anything about it for a long time, until they got this idea in their head that Russia, which was already over in Alaska and working its way down the northern Pacific coast, had designs on California. Now, there's a little confusion here. You'll often hear, oh yes, Spain heard that Russia was coming to take California, so they decided they better get off the stump and colonize it. Well, actually, Russia wasn't planning to colonize California. It was bad intelligence for the Spanish government. But they were convinced that Russia was a threat, so they wanted to colonize California. And they did that the way they had colonized much of northern Mexico and the American Southwest, which was through a two-pronged approach based primarily around the missions, the Catholic missions in California run by the Franciscan order, with support from the military. And so in 1769, the Spanish sent north a series of expeditions by land and sea to colonize California, led by, on the military side, Gaspar de Portola, and Father Junipero Serra was the head, the Father Presidente of the Franciscan missions. And they established a chain of 21 missions up and down the California coast from San Diego to Sonoma. And the missions controlled and dominated California for more than 60 years. During that time, Mexico revolted, broke away from Spain, set up first the Mexican Republic and then the Mexican Empire, and California went with them and was essentially a territory of Mexico. And Mexico looked at California a little differently than Spain did. Mexico was looking for ways to actually colonize the area, not just to Christianize the Indians, teach them the Spanish, Mexican, European skills. And the Indians, by the way, under Spanish law, under Mexican law, were already considered citizens of the empire. Not something the United States government didn't get around to doing. We didn't recognize all Indians as citizens until 1924. So Spain had about a 400-year jump on us on that count. But the Mexican government was looking for ways to bring non-Indian settlers, bring Mexican, Spanish, and other settlers into California. And the tool that they adopted to do this were the Mexican ranchos, the vast land grants, which came to cover much of coastal and interior California. Now, there's a confusion here, because you will often hear people talk about Spanish land grants. There were technically no Spanish land grants. When Spain ruled California, all the land was considered to be the property of the king. Anyone else was simply using it on his permission. The Indians were recognized as having a possessory right, the right to go on and live in their permanent villages where they'd always lived, even when there was a rancho. The missions were simply holding the land in trust for the Indian, the neophytes who were there at the missions. But there was no private ownership of land as such. And what actually happened was, as some of these Spanish soldiers who come to protect the missions started to retire, the governor, the Spanish officials, would give them a grazing concession, give them a permit to occupy an area. And so you had the earliest ranchos were simply held on a lease, almost, from the Spanish government. But the land belonged to the king. Some of these earliest ranchos, starting in about 1784, were somewhat vague and also somewhat huge for that reason. The first one that takes in any part of Orange County went to a retired Spanish soldier by the name of Manuel Nieto. And Nieto was given everything from the Santa Ana River to the San Gabriel River, and from the ocean to the hills, about the Whittier Narrows, that area today. Ballpark it at around 300,000 acres that he was given the right to run cattle on. Now, the priests at Mission San Gabriel to the north here immediately protested and says, we're using a lot of that land right now. So they cut Nieto's ranch down to about 180,000 acres after the mission got back the chunk that they wanted. But remember, he didn't own it. He was there on right from the king. And we had a few other early Spanish concessions, not grants, here in Orange County and in Southern California during time of Spanish rule. And even after Mexico breaks away, 1821, when Mexico breaks away from Spain, it's still about another 15 years until the Mexican government decides we're going to change the order of things in California. We're going to secularize the missions. That is to say, we're going to strip them of their lands, turn them into parish churches in the communities that have grown up around them, and we're going to start giving away land. And you sometimes hear it said as if this process was fairly haphazard, fairly loosely run. But in fact, the law that was set up to cover the land grants is quite specific in all the details. And it essentially said that any citizen in good standing, any Mexican citizen in good standing, could select a tract of land as long as it was unoccupied. Now, that didn't cover the Indians. The Indians were considered to have the rights to be there. Their villages were protected. Meaning, if no other ranchero, no other mission was using that land, they could select it and send a petition to the governor of California asking for that land. And the first thing that had to go with that petition was a map, a diseño, as they said in Spanish, which was really a sketch map based on landmarks. They're very seldom measured maps in these days. And the governor would turn around and send this petition and send this map back to one of the local officials, either the military commander of the area, or if there was a community like Los Angeles nearby, they would have an alcalde who was kind of a one-man band when it came to the municipal organization. He was not only the mayor, but he was also the judge and anything, pretty much anything else. He was the governor's representative there. And the alcalde would either know the area, know the person requesting the grant already, or would go out and make investigation, visit the site, ask questions. And if he found that the land was indeed vacant, that the person had the means to stock it with cattle and develop it, because that was the whole point, we want to develop the country, he would then send a report back to the governor saying, yes, this all looks fine, or he might not. He might say, this area that he requests is already used by so-and-so, so you might break this out. But they would come back to the point where it would go back to the governor, and if the governor was finally satisfied, he would sign off, really just note in the margin, to let the title issue to the person. And his secretary would then prepare the actual grant, and the government would prepare their copy of it and would send an original signed by the governor to this ranchero, to the grant. Technically, it was then supposed to go before the state assembly, or the territorial assembly, I should say, under Mexican law, and they would pass on it also and approve it. So it had to be approved technically by the governor and by the legislature, by the assembly. And every so often they would meet and would pass on a bunch of them, but. All of this then was gathered up, all of these materials, the petition, the original diseño or map, the informador, the report that went back from the alcalde, the grant, everything was put together into an expediente, into a grant file, and that remained in the government archives in Monterey in those days, in the capital of Spanish and Mexican California. And then, when the grant was given, there were also rules and tradition involved in taking possession of the land. The rancheros were expected to occupy the land, stock it with livestock, build on the land. They would have it surveyed after the fashion of the time. The usual means was to bring in a group of outside people to work the survey. Some of the community leaders or rancheros from the surrounding ranches. It's a good way to make sure everyone agrees on the boundaries. And you'd mount two men on horseback with pikes, with a reata, with a lariat between them. And you would ride ahead. The reata might be 100 varas, 300 yards or so. And one man would plant the pole, the second one would ride ahead and plant, and then you'd ride past him and keep going and mark landmarks along the way to mark out and map the boundary of them, and they might even do some of the ancient traditions where the new owner would pull up grass and throw it, and some of the old, you know, move stones, and these are all, you know, medieval traditions of saying, my land now. And some of those were still done. The grants were limited in size under Mexican law. The maximum that could be granted was 11 square leagues, call it 45,000 acres. So that when we got to actual grants, they were much smaller than these early Spanish concessions. And that was the official procedure starting mostly in about 1834, 35, and building up speed as we move on through the next decade or so. And there are more than 800 of these grants made in California, mostly in about that 12-year period, ending in 1846 during the Mexican War, when the Americans captured California. The official date, the date that Commodore Sloat sailed into the state capital at Monterey and captured the capital, is July 7, 1846. And that marks the end of any recognized grants by our government. So one of the things that happened as these new Mexican grants came in is these older rancheros who had these Spanish concessions went to the new Mexican government and got grants instead. But of course, some of them were huge, these ranchos. So for example, Manuel Nieto's children went in and got five separate grants made out to all the children to cover that 170,000 acres or so that's there. And you get the Rancho Las Bolsas and the Rancho Los Alamitos and the Los Cerritos, the Los Coyotes, and the Santa Gertrudis Rancho. There's a question about those ranchos because the Alamitos was granted to one of the sons, who 5 days later turned around and sold it to the governor for pennies, really. It was about $500, but even in those days, that was nothing for a stocked cattle ranch of about 30,000 acres. And so there was always a little question of, governor signed the grant giving him the land, and 5 days later he sells it back to the governor. And there were things like that then, as now. The other main ranchero, Spanish ranchero family here, were the Yormas and the Peraltas, who had the grant, whereas Nieto's grant was on the west side of the Santa Ana River. Where we are now is the old Yorma and Peralta family rancho, the Rancho Santiago de Santa Ana. And again, they had this old Spanish concession, which in its earliest form dated back to about 1800. They had a formal grant made by the Mexican government. And as that family descendants spread out, they continued to make application for all the adjoining land. And so one of the oldest sons, Bernardo Yorma, went north of the Santa Ana River, requested his own grant in 1834 for the Rancho Cañon de Santa Ana, which is where the community of Yorba Linda is today. And then he was able to buy into some of the grants moving east into what is now Riverside County and the Rancho La Sierra and the Rancho Rincon. And so eventually, by about 1845 or so, the Yorba family could start on the edge of Riverside, where Riverside is today, and ride all the way down here to the ocean at Newport Beach and never leave the family lands that were here. That was all one family. I mentioned the petitions that they had to file. I have an example from the Yormas here. This is actually their petition for the concession from the Spanish government. They'd been using it for a number of years, but in 1809 they finally got around to getting the formal paperwork taken care of. And it's addressed to El Señor Gobernador. Antonio Yorba, retired sergeant of the Presidial Company of San Diego, appears before your excellency with the greatest submission and represents that while your exceeding your excellency was governor ad interim of Lower California, the deceased ensign, Don Pablo Grijalva, through Don Manuel Rodriguez, presented a petition soliciting the place called Santiago for the purpose of building a house thereon in company with your petitioner and uniting our animals and cultivating it, both of us, for the common enjoyment of all the above-mentioned benefit which the place may afford. I am aware and understand that the deceased has not mentioned me in his petition, but nevertheless, inasmuch as I had so agreed to the contract of co-partnership with the said deceased, we have continued together to the present. You can see they're just laying it on. We're going to be formal here. In consequence of the death of the deceased ensign, various persons have been placed in charge of the place, and now I and Juan Peralta have jointly agreed to settle the place called Santiago. I, for my part, placing thereon one of my sons, both being married, for the purpose of taking care of the number of 300 head of cattle and the corresponding number of horses, which is the stock that will now be upon said tract of land, beside the seed we contemplate sowing for our maintenance. In view of all the foregoing, reminding the goodness of your excellency that I have a large family, my continued personal labors unobstructed by my sesquicentennial age, who's in his 70s, are not enough for me to sufficiently support. Wherefore I pray and supplicate your excellency may be pleased to issue the grant of the said place of Santiago in favor of your petitioner, in order that the company, that in company with said Juan Peralta, his labors may prove favorable and profitable to both petitioners, a benefit and favor for which he will be grateful and obliged to you. And he got his concession to the land. That Santiago de Santa Ana grant totaled about, the Spanish concession, I should say, totaled about 80,000 acres. And brings up an interesting point. I mentioned when they would do the surveys of the land and run the reata around, measuring off the vadas around the boundaries of the ranch, they would use all kinds of landmarks. And you will read sometimes in histories of California where they will, well, frankly, poke a little fun at some of the landmarks. And it will be a steer's skull on a stick, or a certain forked tree, or this particular rock or that. But these were known places. I mean, if they had to mount a boundary, they had to mount it. But these would be very distinctive trees or very distinctive rock piles. And one of the curious ones that comes into some of the ranchos as a landmark is actually mentioned in one of them, that the landmark is the hill on which Bernardo Yorba sits on horseback. Now, that's the image they want you to get. That the guys were out there surveying, and Bernardo was up watching, and that was their land. That hill, the one he's on right now. But in fact, that was a place everybody knew, because Bernardo would ride up behind his house in the Santa Ana Canyons and have a particular point that he liked to take a look across. There was a good vantage point. You could still identify it today. There are enough references to it even into the 1930s, that if I wanted to pull some old maps and work on it, I'm sure I could go stand you on top of whatever house is now on the hill on which Bernardo Yorba sits on horseback. And so these boundaries are not as vague. They were understood. Yes, they were a little bit soft, let us say. People's cattle wandered back and forth, but they sorted them out. That's what a rodeo was for, was to sort out the cattle and decide, get everybody's cattle branded and marked. And one of the important proofs that you owned your rancho was when there were stray calves, when they'd do the roundups, and they would normally pull all the calves together, the cows here, and you'd see which cow they went to. And if it had a Yorba brand on it, it gets a Yorba brand on the calf, or a Sepulveda brand or a Carrillo brand. But you always had the strays who had lost their mother for whatever reason, the Orenas. And they went to the person whose land they were found on. That was one of the things that showed it was your land, was you got the strays. That was actually used in some of the lawsuits of later years to indicate that everybody knew whose land it was and whose cattle belonged to who. So that while the system had a certain softness to it, in the end, if you pushed it, you could define who owned exactly what and where. Here in Orange County, almost every part of the lowlands and even the small little pasture lands up in the mountains were all granted as ranchos in that period, starting in about 1834, when we were actually granting the five Nieto ranchos, which are all or part in Orange County, the three different Yorba ranchos, the Sepulveda's Rancho, which is the Rancho San Joaquin, which becomes the heart of the Irvine Ranch, the Rancho San Juan Cajon de Santa Ana, which is where Anaheim is today, the Rancho La Habra up in the northern end of the county, the Rancho Tribuco down south, the Rancho Niguel. Niguel is interesting, I might add, the only Indian place name that's still in current use in Orange County. The missionaries that had learned from the Indians the name of this particular stream along Aliso Creek that was called Niguel. And so the mission used that name for their pastures. And when it became a rancho, when the Avila family had it as a rancho, it was the Rancho Niguel. And there's still a city of Laguna Niguel down in South Orange County today. And so that almost all of Orange County was granted as one rancho or other. And the ranchos all pretty much met. The boundaries pretty much met, and the odd and stray places where they didn't meet became some of the early communities, because you could go in and homestead. And so one of the odd places that's missed is Laguna Beach. The actual bottom of the canyon and Laguna Beach was between the Rancho San Joaquin and the Rancho Niguel, and they didn't quite meet. Now, in Mexican times, we would have assumed that they met there. But the Americans, when they did formal surveys, there wasn't always as much land to go around as the grant might have called for, when they stuck to that 11 league, that 44,000 acre limit. We also had one curious one. We have a ghost rancho in Orange County. The Rancho In 1846, Felipe Carrillo got a grant to a rancho called Los Desechos. Desechos are, it's the rough lands is what it means. And this is the area where the city of San Clemente is today, in the southern tip of the county. And Carrillo never pursued that grant. Carrillo never pursued it with the Americans, and so it officially ceased to exist, and that area became open land and available to be developed. Because the ranchos, as long as these ranchos existed, as long as these lands were held by these families or the people who bought them from these families, that locked up most of the land here. And so one of the main ways that the ranchos influence Orange County is as they are, only as they are broken up can community development begin. 1868 is the big year. In 1868, most of the Nieto properties, which were then owned by an early American settler named Abel Stearns, who'd come here in the early days and run a store in Los Angeles and started buying up these Mexican ranchos as they came on the market. He bought the one from the governor's estate that he bought for $500 off the Nieto boy. Stearns' ranchos all went on the market, and the Yorba Rancho was all broken up that same year in 1868. And so within 5 years, you get the cities of Santa Ana, Orange, Tustin, Westminster, all started the beginnings of the communities that are going to become Garden Grove and Newport Beach and Fountain Valley, and all these settlers coming in all at once because suddenly all this rancho land was available. But there was a problem in many ways. First, when California took passed to the United States at the end of the Mexican War, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, In the treaty, the U.S. government promised to recognize all existing property rights in California. Something I might add, they did not necessarily do, particularly when it came to the Indians and their possessory rights to the lands. Well, things, of course, were happening quickly in California in those days. About a week before the treaty was signed, a carpenter named James Marshall looked down into the mill race at Sutter's Mill that he was building up on the American River and thought he saw something shining in the water there. And it is one of the ironies of history that at the same time that Mexico was giving up California, the great gold rush was being started. And this huge rush of people in the year 1849, the most famous year of the gold rush, something like 100,000 people poured into California at once. And up north, they did not worry much about who owned what cattle ranching Mexican owned some piece of land or another. And most of the ranchos, many of the ranchos, particularly in the Bay Area, were just just driven out of existence by Americans coming in and just settling on the land, just totally ignoring any Mexican ranchero rights to the land. Here in Southern California, it was almost the reverse. The gold rush was this huge boom for the ranchos, the rancheros down here. Because for years, their cattle ranches, all they have to sell are the hides and the tallow from the cattle to the ships that come from the U.S. and from England and other parts of the world, coming around the horn here to California to buy the green tan California hides, the California banknotes, take them back around to where the leather would be processed and made into products, and they would bring back the same shoes the next year that had been made from California leather to trade for more hides in the next season. Now suddenly, 1848, 1849, you've got a market for beef, and cattle that were worth $2 a head for hides and tallow could now be driven to Northern California and sold for $15, $20, $25, $30 a head to miners up in the gold country. So this whole, you know, there's this image of the rich California rancheros with their grand house full of silks and items brought from the Orient, wearing all the wealth of the rancho on their back and their beautiful silver-pointed saddles. And it's true, they did live like that for a while, but not in Mexican times. That image really comes out of the 1850s when they all got rich during the gold rush. But they made the mistake that a lot of people make when times are good, and they assumed it was going to last forever. And of course it didn't. The gold rush trickles down to where you don't have the huge throngs of people coming here anymore. It's much more corporate in those days. People begin bringing in cattle and sheep from other areas to fill that market as well. And then in the early 1860s, we have a tremendous drought here in Southern California, 1863, 64, terrible drought year, cattle dying by the tens of thousands down here. And most of these rancheros found themselves stretched, and many of them were forced to sell. But what really drives it all is something the United States government did. As I mentioned, up north, they pretty much ignored these grants, and there was a big push, and the senators who were elected from California, of course, came from up north, and there was this push to deal with the whole question of who owns what in California. We promised by treaty we would respect the land rights in California, but being the federal government, they added a layer of bureaucracy. And they said, oh yes, 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 we want to recognize all these grants, but we're not just going to take the Mexican archives and see here are the grants, here are the maps, here's the information. Oh no, we're going to go back and start over. Every single owner of a grant in California, some 800 of them, was required by the Land Act of 1851 to present their claim to a federal commission that met in San Francisco for most of its existence, and to basically prove that they owned what in some cases their families had owned for more than 65 years, starting with those Spanish concessions. And the Mexican archives were not perfect, people had passed away, documents had been lost, and so you created this boon for the attorneys to come in and go to work, and this boon for surveyors, I might add, to come in and go to work and to find witnesses, find documents, and or create documents and create witnesses. There was quite a little bit of that going on. There were some hugely famous examples of, I think there were either four or six people who all came forward and said, I have the grant, says I own the San Francisco Peninsula, for example. None of them did. Some of them even went to the trouble to go to Mexico and insert forged documents in the Mexican government records that were kept there, the copies that had been sent to Mexico City. Some hugely elaborate frauds that the Land Commission had to detect. But the vast majority of the claims were good, solid rancho claims that the families had occupied for years. And there should have been no question about and no reason to put them through all of these hoops. And it gets worse. After you've made your claim, after you've brought in all your witnesses, after you've presented all your paperwork, then the commission could approve it. Thumbs up, thumbs down from the Land Commission. Except those decisions were immediately appealed to the Attorney General. And then if the Attorney General said yay or nay, you still have the opportunity to appeal it again to the courts. And so this could drag on, and did drag on, for decades before the U.S. government finally recognized some of these grants, issued a federal patent with an official survey attached to it. The Yorba Rancho, Santiago de Santa Ana, dating back to about 1800, was not actually confirmed until 1883, got the final patent and map. By that time, it had all been broken up and sold, and whole cities existed on the land. But the process dragged on and on and on, and that's really more than the weather or any of these other things. That's what drove not just the Mexican rancheros, but the Americans who'd come in here. Stearns went broke, and a lot of these other people who came in. Juan Forrester, the Englishman who had most of the southern ranches, he had basically everything from Oceanside to Irvine was what Mr. Forrester came to own. He went broke, died broke. So it was not a question of, oh, these Mexican rancheros couldn't keep up with the system. No, the system wouldn't allow any ranchero, whether they were Mexican or American or British or French or Belgian or anywhere else, that people from all those parts of the world had grants in California, could not survive under this system we created with the Land Commission and the review. And even then, with the Land Commission, you had games being played. And probably the biggest one I already alluded to, which was when they came down to actually formally survey out this land, full meets and bounds modern surveys, they sometimes found there wasn't enough land to go around. That the grant may have called for 10 leagues, and the grant had been, you know, people had been using 60 or 70,000 acres. So now you had to decide what 40,000 acres of that did they get. And since the boundaries could be a little vague, you could float the ranchos. And there are some very famous examples of trying to float the ranchos this way or that way, particularly into the mining areas. The most famous ones are all mining. In San Diego County, the Cuyamaca grant, they attempted to float north over the Julian gold mines. In Riverside County, the Rancho San Jacinto Nuevo was floated over, I believe, to take in what they hoped would be one of the few tin mines in America, in Temescal Canyon. The Quicksilver mines up in the southern gold country, the New Almaden mines. There were questions for years about whose rancho covered where the mines was and who got that. And people knew which surveyors you went to there were surveyors who had the reputation that basically you give them the piece of paper, you give them the written description, the diseño, and they can pretty much put your rancho anywhere you want it. So there is plenty of chicanery to go around in this process, but it does not dilute the fact that most of the grants were valid, most of the ranchers owned what they owned and had always owned it. And as I say, it was much worse up in Northern California, where the Peraltas and the Carrillos and a lot of those families out there were just literally drowned in trespassers and squatters on the land. Here in Southern California, these ranchers at least had a fighting chance. And some of them still exist today in parts of Southern California. The land is still pretty much intact and used for cattle. In Northern San Diego County, the old Valle de San Jose, what came to be known by its American owner as the Warner Ranch, still basically intact and cattle grazing land the way it has been since mission times. So you know, down south here, we've still got some of these ranches in existence. Here in a place like Orange County, of course, long gone, but once you know what to look for, once you take these rancho maps that the Land Commission had created in the 1850s and 60s and 70s and 80s, which are the basis for most of our maps today, you can start to look around and see things that still represent those ranchos. Of course, the names are already mentioned, these community names, and we have a city of Los Alamitos, and we have a city of La Habra, and we have a city of Santa Ana, and the Laguna Niguel city. You get the names, but you also find that the streets follow some of these rancho boundary lines. It's easy to spot, especially when they run at an odd angle. Here in Orange County, one of the landmarks that was commonly used for several of the ranchos, three of them actually met at this point, there's a hill here above Tustin that is still called Red Hill today. And Red Hill is red because it had cinnabar. In fact, they mined mercury there at different times over the years. But it was a well-known, everyone knew that hill, this Red Hill standing up above the plain there. And so the line at Red Hill, the Red Hill is called out in several of the grants. And it happens that the grants also use a good landmark, the top of Newport Bay. Well, if you draw a line from Red Hill to the top of Newport Bay, you get a line running kind of southwesterly. And if you look at a map of Orange County sometime, you will see that when you get down to that part of the county where the Irvine Ranch started, as the Irvines bought this stuff up in later years, that suddenly the whole county takes goes cockeyed. Because it's all based on the rancho line. The 55 freeway here follows that line, the Red Hill follows that line, and the Irvine surveyed everything based on that, squared up to that rancho line that really dates to about 1800. You will find it in city limits. You will definitely find it in tract boundaries and you will see some of these funny lines show up on some subdivision or tract, because of course the person who bought it, if he's only buying that one piece out of the rancho, wasn't able to necessarily buy the adjoining piece. There's a big long stretch of the Rancho Los Coyotes that actually comes to a point in the middle of Orange County, and in the northern Orange County. And the reason is there was one particular spring that was called out in the description of the grant, and they knew, because this one was being done correctly, that this spring had to be on the grant there. And so they just stretched out this long triangle, okay, we got the spring, I forget what it was called in Spanish. And you still see that today, and in fact there's a road follows part of that funny triangular line there. So you can see all sorts of ways that the ranchos are still visible today, but what's more important is how historically they still affect us today. The ranchos, these Mexican ranchos, are what create the basis for all private property in those parts of Southern California, all of California, not just Southern. As I say, all but the northernmost and easternmost counties of California all had Mexican grants in them. That was the first privately owned land in California. Before that was the king, Belong El Rey in Madrid, in Spain. And so the ranchos become the basis for private property in much of California. And the boundaries of the ranchos, the ownership of the ranchos, the changing ownership of the ranchos, I should say, leads to most of the community development here. That until these ranchos were broken up, partitioned, divided by the courts, split up by the families, however they were done in different ways, only then could modern community development begin in California. Only then could that private land start changing hands in smaller pieces. Because until that was done, you had a single rancho, the Yorbas, this 80,000 acre rancho Santiago de Santa Ana, as late as 1867, was one single parcel of land with something like 300 to 400 owners of undivided interests in the grants. When they went to divvy it up, some people got as much as 4,000 or 5,000 acres, you know, some of the older generations. Some of the later owners who just bought up a fractional interest got as little as 50 acres as we chopped this all up and divided this up. But as I say, once we did that, almost instantly you get new community development coming in here. So the ranchos are part of the real base and foundation of the development of much of California. They are historic in, you know, with a capital H, yes, they are part of our history. It is an interesting story, an era that's still with us. But they are also historic in the sense of creating the pattern for development in so much of California, including here in Orange County as we look around today. And that's why we hoped that knowing a little bit more of that story would maybe open your eye a little bit the next time you're looking at some description that mentions this rancho or that rancho as still part of the chain that connects us to that, because you folks are in a position where you are looking much more minutely at these parts of California history, have to actually understand them, which I have to freely admit, having now worked in the county archives for a few years, not even all the historians fully understand all of this stuff. They also could stand to learn a little bit about the ranchos and their impact and how and what and where and who and why of the California ranchos. And so when given the invitation to come here today, thought that this might be something that, if nothing else, might give you a little smile and a nod the next time you run into one of those old rancho names, and maybe make you think about the bigger picture of how this all fits. Because I think that's the best thing we can do with our history, is to understand how it brought us to where we are today. Thank you.
Yes, I grew up in Orange County. I went to school with Yorbas and things like that. You know, and I knew that was supposed to be significant, but anyway, it's more fun to hear about this when I, you know I knew some of them. But we always thought of the area of Irvine as being in a land grant, and it was undeveloped when I was a young person.
Sure, and even when I was a young person, okay. It was undeveloped,
and so
for the most part.
Here sat this piece of land right in the middle of this land of riches, undeveloped, and then suddenly it was able to be developed. I've always wondered what happened that, you know, allowed this to be developed.
Well, we're talking about the Irvine Ranch, which was about a fifth of Orange County in the old days, about 115,000 acres, made up of two Mexican ranchos and part of a third. And actually originally bought by James Irvine and his partners for sheep ranches. After the Civil War, with the cotton industry destroyed in the South, there was a sudden boom in sheep ranching on the old Mexican ranchos. Of course, a lot of the cattle had died a few years before in the droughts, and there were lots of distress sales going on. So Irvine came in and bought this. And undeveloped, this should make it clear to people, it was undeveloped in the sense of residential and commercial development. It was agriculturally developed to the hilt. You have major agricultural development on the ranch, citrus, cattle, lima beans, of all things. Irvine Ranch was one of the lima bean capitals of the world. Where the El Toro Marine Base is was one of the biggest contiguous lima bean fields in the nation, some of the richest farmland on the ranch. They say that old Mr. Irvine begged the federal government to never take that part of the ranch for the air base. That, you know, put it at Pilot on the ranch. He didn't mind having the Marine Base on the ranch, but please, please don't take it right in the middle of the best farmland on the ranch, and they did anyway. Well, what happened, of course, is Southern California started to grow in the 1950s, in the years after World War II. The Irvines could see what was coming, and there was some resistance among the old guard against developing the ranch, but eventually they saw that it's going to happen. We're going to have the families getting, like the old Mexican rancheros, are getting to be too many descendants, too many owners out there, and the time's going to come when we're going to have to do something. And so they hit upon doing a master plan community on Irvine. What really prompted it was the University of California Irvine in the late 50s, when they were looking for a new Southern California University site. And the Irvines decided, over some dissension among the board, to get in and offer the state, I think it was 500 acres initially. And that became the catalyst for, now we're going to have this university, we want to start developing a modern planned community around it. And so they hired William Pereira and his staff to start developing the Irvine Ranch, the development plan, which is still going on today, and creating Irvine. Of course, the Irvine family, long since out of the picture, we're two or three corporations down the line from the old Irvine company. And it's still going on. I might mention I think here's the ultimate in Irvine. There's a new gated community, fairly new gated community in Irvine at Sand Canyon, which when you go into this gated community, there are gated neighborhoods in the gated community.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Is Rancho Viejo a true rancho?
The Rancho Mission Viejo, yes, was. Of course, you would have said Mission Vieja. During the land commission days, a lot of these names got turned into, gringo eyes, I guess we'd say. But the Mission Viejo was a Mexican grant of former mission lands there, and there was a tradition which is based on truth, but not exactly true, that the mission had been not always right there in San Juan Capistrano, where the mission is today in Southern Orange County. And so that was the old mission, the Mission Viejo. And that was granted originally, I believe, to the Arguello family, and then Forrester had it, and it passed on through the O'Neill family ended up getting a hold of it. And it's been the O'Neills who have developed Mission Viejo and Rancho Santa Margarita and Ladera Ranch and a number of these other communities down there. But no, that is the rancho. Well, again, thank you for the chance to be here. I hope the rest of your conference goes very well, and you have a nice visit in Orange County.